Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi, and I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and host of Sea Control's Asia Pacific series. Today, I'll have two guests, Dr. Benjamin Shreya at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and Dr. Tomohiko Satake from the National Institute for Defence Studies in Tokyo. They'll be talking about the recent changes to Japan's interpretation of its constitution, specifically Article 9 on the right to collective self-defense. We'll be discussing the implications for relations with China, implications for international security, as well as the deepening of security relations between Australia and Japan. But before we get to that, we'll be back after this short break.
Hola, nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi and welcome back. We're here with my two guests today to discuss strategic changes in Japan. One of my guests is Dr. Benjamin Shreya, who's a senior analyst with me at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And our special guest for today is a visiting fellow at ASPI. It's Tomohiko Satake, who is a research analyst at the National Institute for Defense Studies in Tokyo. Thank you very much for joining me, gentlemen. Both of our guests today, obviously research on Northeast Asia, will be talking today about constitutional changes and a little bit about the strategic environment. So what we'll do is we'll start with Tomo. Mm-hmm. If you could just talk a little bit about what's been going on with Japan. Why has there been this sudden push for constitutional reinterpretation by the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe?
Okay. First of all, it's very important to understand this is not a constitutional change, but the change of interpretation of constitution. So that is the point that I have to make. I think the current changes in Japanese security policies are pretty much driven by our perception that the security environment surrounding Japan is increasingly severe and harsh and tense because of North Korea's, nuclear North Korea and, Chinese assertive behavior and relative declining power. So in order to respond to those changes, our security policies should be more flexible and more adaptable. I think this is the bottom line behind the, current changes in interpretation. The constitution, whatever, including the collective self-defense. But at the same time, I think this is a part of a long-term trend toward the normalization of Japan, since the end of the Cold War. As you know, the Japan's security policy is sometimes described as a kind of Yoshida doctrine, which maintained the U.S.-Japan alliance on the one hand and the peace constitution on the other. And Yoshida doctrine is just like, and Japan has been maintained relatively low profile in terms of security policies while supporting those two pillars. That is the Yoshida doctrine. But even inside the Yoshida doctrine, we have been increasing our autonomy, roles and capabilities of the self-defense forces. And especially since after the Cold War, Japan, SDF, has expanded its role from Japanese defense to, regional and global stabilities, including UN peacekeeping, HADR, and humanitarian, effort or that kind of thing. So I think the current effort of the Japanese government to change interpretation, constitution, whatever, is a part of that process of Japanese normalization within the framework of Yoshida doctrine. So it's not a radical departure from the past. Policies. It's still, within the framework of this doctrine, but Japan is increasing its, roles and capability. That is my view.
I see. Ben, what's your take on these things?
Well, I agree with Tomo. You can go back, actually, into the 1990s, where you had, several discussions about reinterpreting Article 9 of the Constitution, where you had first attempts being made to adjust Japan's defense policy to the new environment. In 1996, the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines. So it's not such a radical change. I agree with Tom. It's a long term development, a gradual development. That also goes for Japanese defense capability and force posturing. So lots of what we see now under the Abe government in terms of, you know, actual force structure decisions, these are things that have already been or that have been built upon by what has happened during the previous government. So, for example, the new National Defense Policy Guidelines of December last year, they actually build on the National Defense Policy Guidelines of 2010. And they already had at the centerpiece the concept of a dynamic defense force. Now they call it a joint dynamic defense force. So the whole idea being more capable of providing the Americans with support in the event of a major conflict over Japan. It's not about deploying Japanese forces, to Japan, to Iraq, for example, and fighting wars. And as Tomo said, for the reinterpretation of the Constitution, it's very narrowly defined issues of collective self-defense, which is the right of every nation. My view of the reinterpretation is it is basically about allowing Japan to help the United States to defend Japan, which we would expect every sovereign nation to be able to do. So I agree with Tomo absolutely. It is gradual, long-term change, but it is not towards a more assertive Japan. You know, the repeated criticism that we hear by China in particular, but also some other countries.
Okay, well, I'm actually glad that you brought up Japan. Are you talking about defending, you know, the United States, you have the United States defending Japan for an attack over Japan? I mean, the question really becomes a defense of what? So what I'd like to explore now is a little bit about what the impact will be on the dynamic of the Japanese-Chinese relationship here. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems as though, I mean, there's a lot of criticism from China about these moves. So can I ask you to lend perhaps an Australian perspective on this particular matter, on Japanese-Chinese relations?
Yeah, sure. I think we have to look at the some structural factors that make it extremely difficult for both countries to, you know, to manage their dispute, particularly over the Senkaku Islands. I mean, most people have, you know, some understand, oh, these are just a couple of rocks. Why would these two countries go to war over a couple of rocks? But we have to understand it's much more than rocks. It's about geopolitical positioning. It's about national prestige. And you have a couple of structural factors. So you have a rising China, which is increasingly willing to exert its influence, who's building capabilities and who's deploying those capabilities in waters very close to Japan. At the same time, you have a Japan which is in decline, which is sort of unsure about what its role is, but which is, of course, determined to defend what it sees at its primary area of interest. And then you have the U.S. In all of this in between, who sort of tries to manage this very delicate relationship. And on top of that, as Tomo has said, you have nationalism. And that makes for a very, very difficult situation, which basically leads to the fact that both countries have to find ways to, you know, manage their conflicts rather than trying to solve it. So I think on top of those force structure developments that Tomo has just outlined, it will be very important for both sides, for example, to come to hotlines, red lines, and being able sort of to work around those difficult issues.
All right. And speaking of force structure, Japan has recently released a new version of their white paper, which is an annual document. So,
right.
I mean, for the benefit of our readers, in order for them to catch up on what the main points are, Tom, can I ask you to just summarize it?
First of all, it's very important to, you know, note that the Japan's white paper is not like Australia's white paper. I think what is equivalent to Australia's defense white paper is the National Defense Program Guideline. So Japan's defense white paper is, as you said, it's a kind of annual update. So defense update to Australia. Having said that, this year's white paper is a kind of first white paper after Japan established the National Security Council, or Japan decided to exercise the right of coexistence defense. And it's also, you know, this year marks the 60th anniversary of the self-defense forces, and the 40th anniversary since the first white paper was, you know, established. So that's kind of a memorial in white paper.
Yeah, important context there.
Yeah. And I found there are some important elements here. I think this is a first white paper which clearly mentioned that China has been trying to expand kind of A2AD, you know, anti-access, capabilities. And of course, you know, the previous white papers mentioned about that, but not in this context, you know, not clearly mentioned that, that one thing. And also, you know, white paper criticized Chinese unilateral setting of ages, you know, and, I think the other thing is that the white paper emphasized space and Japan's defense effort in space and cybersecurity, perhaps more than ever before. So those are new elements. And of course, there are still many continuities, you know, as I said, defense of Southwest Island and you know, as men said, dynamic joint defense forces and US-Japan alliance and cooperation with partners, including Australia, mm-hmm. and Japan's proactive contribution to peace in peacekeeping and global activities and that kind of things. These are all kind of continuities. As for the defense budget, Japan decided to increase the defense budget by 2.8% compared to the previous year, but that includes a kind of the increase of labor costs and as well as taxes. So, you know, essentially, it's a kind of same level, I would say. You know, it's not a... Significant
increase. Okay, great. Look, I'm going to turn to Ben for a second because I know, Ben, you've written recently, some critique of the New Japan White Paper. What do you see when you look at the White Paper?
Well, I see, apart from the things that Tomo said, I see that this White Paper now really clearly makes Japan as almost the core for structure determinant. Yes, North Korea still is important, and one of the decisions in the White Paper has been to sort of upgrade the ballistic missile defense capability on Japanese warships. But I think apart from that, you can clearly see that China and sort of a defensive posture against China, or a Japanese version of anti-access era denial against the Chinese is now the key force structure determinant that also plays in the U.S. in the U.S. context. And I think if you look across the board, there's this tendency sometimes to say, oh, you know, these white papers, they just they cement the status quo. There's nothing really new, da da da. But I think in this white paper, you can actually see some bold decisions to increase that very capacity, and that goes particularly for land forces, for the ground self-defense force. And what I have in mind in particular is sort of a decision to, for example, deploy observatory units on almost all of Japan's southwesternmost islands. And what that basically implies is Japan seems to now see a necessity to have actually people on potentially disputed islands as a sort of a tripwire for potential Chinese provocations. Final point on the budget there, I also agree. I think we really have to put these things in perspective here. Yes, Japan for the second time has increased defense spending, but it comes after more than a decade of consistent downgrading or decreasing defense spending. So Japan still is nowhere near of what it spent back in the early 2000s. And then on top of that, we have the problem of rising personnel costs, but also rising unit costs of very expensive weapon platforms. So for example, when we're talking about warships are becoming increasingly more expensive because of the level of sophistication. That from a Japanese perspective means you've struggled very hard to keep up with the number of vessels that you have at this point of time. So what you aim to do is, rather than increasing the fleet, you want to keep the number of your fleet and you want to modernize it. And therefore, one of the most interesting decisions from my point of view was the decision to increase the number of destroyers. But actually, when you look at the platforms that Japan wants to acquire, these are smaller and therefore less expensive destroyers than the ones that Japan previously procured. That, I think, is reflective of that need to keep the fleet in terms of numbers as much as you can, while increasing the capability of those platforms. So what that means in a Chinese, Japanese context is that Chinese will be able to increase, you know, numbers at a rate that Japan just cannot match. But it's having that sort of technologically very adept for similar sort of in an Australian context, you know, superiority through technology. And of course, in the US context, that adds significantly to Japan's defensive posture.
I mean, so far we've talked a little bit about what this means for Japan and what this means for Japan-China relations and in Northeast Asia. I'd like to switch now a little bit to what this kind of means for the United States, obviously it's an alliance part of Japan, and what it means for international security. Right. Tomo, your past research has talked about burden sharing with the United States. Yeah. So, I mean, could you talk a little bit about what the implications are of these changes in Japan, you know, what the U.S. might expect from Japan?
Yeah, okay. As you know, the U.S. is, you know, rebalancing, you know, its military resources to Asia-Pacific region. And I think U.S. rebalance has a kind of two aspects. One is to keep strong commitment to Asia-Pacific region, but on the other hand, you know, calls for greater burden sharing from regional allies and friends. And so these are two elements of rebalancing. And in that case, you know, what is the burden we have to assume? That's a very important question. And what the U.S. calls for, you know, requires, you know, it's not only our defense effort, you know, increasing the defense capability, but also come regional and even global, you know, activities, including PKO, HADR, and I think capacity building in Southeast Asia is going to be really important issue. And also, you know, having more exercises with other countries, including, you know, Pacific Island or whatever, you know. So these are kind of burden sharing we can probably assume. And another issue we have to care is that the kind of, you know, when you talk about burden sharing, you know, it's always important to realize we have to find out what is our specialties, how we can establish a division of labor between the US and Japan and US Australia, what are these kind of issues. And I think I'm going to talk about this later, but, you know, Japan has a kind of advantage in terms of HADR, PKO, you know, or other defense engagement activities with Southeast Asian countries, compared to the United States or other major powers. So I think these are areas where we can probably put more resources on under the U.S. rebalance strategy.
Okay. Yeah. Ben, turning to you, are these the kind of tasks you think Japan should be doing in terms of international burden sharing?
From a Japanese perspective, but also from an international perspective, what is it that you want? You want to have a Japan which is, active. International security relations that is also a position that Australia, strongly supports. That, of course, doesn't mean a Japan which is in any way, you know, a threat to its neighbors. I think that's a largely constructed, that's very much a constructed argument. But it's a Japan which contributes more to peacekeeping operations. Even though I think we have to keep things in perspective, advanced countries such as Japan or Australia or even the United States, you know, their contribution to peacekeeping operations has been largely limited. Iraq and Afghanistan were not peacekeeping operations. So I do think that, yes, Japan's role in international security when it comes to defense might increase a little, but I would suggest that the focus of Japan will overwhelmingly remain to, you know, become more interoperable with the United States. And I think that from an American point of view, when we talk about burden sharing, is actually the asset or the thing that they're most interested in, apart from Japan providing, you know, bases. Because I think while the U.S. has valued Japan's contribution to the joint defense effort, the U.S. was concerned about the lack of interoperability and jointness amongst the Japanese self-defense force, but then also the working together between U.S. and Japanese forces. And I think there Japan has come quite a long way in the past 5 years, you know, buying more weapon systems which are compatible with the US Joint Strike Fighter, Ospreys, in the future, and increasing their willingness and ability to work with the Americans across the board. And I think that is much more valuable than Japan massively increasing its defense spending, something which is simply not realistic.
I see. Look, I'd like now to move to relations between American allies. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe gave a historic speech last month in the Australian Parliament in English at a time where Australia and Japan are seeking to deepen their security relations, which also involves exploring the exchange of submarine technology.
Right.
So, Tom, I'd like to start with you first.
Yep.
You know, what are the implications there of Japan and Australia deepening their security relationships?
I said, Ben, about this thing, but what surprised me most after coming to Australia is that, you know, I think lots of Australian people understand that Japan's interested in Australia because of Senkaku issues or, you know, as a confrontation with China, that kind of things. But I don't, you know, really agree with that kind of argument. I don't think Japanese government expects, you know, Australia coming to, you know, Senkaku, to, you know, to East China Sea to protect Senkaku or something like that. You know, of course, you know, they can do something little, but I don't think that's the main issue. What I'm saying is that I think Japan and Australia have a kind of long-term cooperation in terms of regional order building issue, including PKO, strategic aid, you know, defense engagement, information exchange in Southeast Asia, and institution building like APEC or ARF. So these are areas where we have to probably enhance our cooperation. And I think, you know, of course, in China is really important, but we have to understand our security cooperation in terms of this broader context of regional order building between Japan and Australia. So that is my argument. And of course, especially important is, like, as I said, defense engagement with Southeast Asian countries or Pacific Islands. These kind of things we can probably cooperate more, you know, providing, you know, some patrolling ships or, you know, maritime security and counter piracy. And there are many things we can probably cooperate, you know. So that's my first thought, I think. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Ben, what about you? What are your thoughts on the deepening of Australia and Japan security relations?
Well, I think it's in both countries' interest, and this is what has been, you know, confirmed by Abbott's visit to Japan and then Shinzo Abe coming over. I think there are, you know, when you go through the list of why it is something useful. First of all, I think, yeah, it very much comes down to order building. We both have a vital interest of maintaining, you know, the strong U.S. position in this region. We are like-minded allies. We share values. And Australia also has an interest in the stability of Northeast Asia. It is not that what happens there is irrelevant to Australia. So I agree that, you know, deepening the defense relationship does not, as some people have argued, automatically tie us to the defense of Japan. I also do fundamentally disagree with people in Australia who said, look, this is, you know, almost a defense alliance. It is nowhere near that. But we have both much to gain from deeper defense cooperation, you know, capacity building in Southeast Asia. Well, potentially cooperation on the submarines, even though I think that's much more challenging than it looks at first sight. But other areas for cooperation, closer military exchange of military information, areas, you know, like anti-submarine warfare, where Japan has outstanding expertise, these kinds of things. So across the board, I think there is lots of scope for deepening the relationship. But I would say that particularly in Japan, but also in Australia, it will be very much dependent on political leadership. So at this point of time, you have two political leaders at the top who are really determined to make this a much deeper relationship. And we have to see what happens if one of those two, or even both, are no longer in office. And both have a hard way of sort of persuading the defense bureaucracies or the bureaucracies that this is actually a good thing and that you really need to go to the next level up. But I do think one driver for the deepening of the bilateral relationship is actually the US alliance. So the US has made it very clear in an ANZUS context with Australia that it wants to see deeper relations with Japan on a bilateral and trilateral level. And I think the US also goes to Japan and says, hey, Australia is one of those partners that you really should increase your relationship with.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to warmly thank our two guests for today, Dr. Tomohiko Sotake and Dr. Benjamin Shria, and for sharing their insights about the developments in Japan, some of the strategic drivers and domestic drivers that have led to some of these changes, and their implications, not only for regional security, for international security, and their relationships with the United States. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And don't forget, you can join us for more episodes of Sea Control either on iTunes or download directly for the SimSep website. And for more in the Asia-Pacific, stay tuned. Thanks very much again. I'm Natalie Sambi for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, signing off.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.